the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Now, my next guest is no stranger to balancing budgets. Her career has taken her from the corridors of government buildings to her role as chairperson of one of Ireland's banks after spending 9 years on the board of Ryanair along the way. Julie O'Neill, you're very welcome to the programme. Julie, as a senior civil servant over many years, you would have watched from the inside as lots of budgets were being finalised. Behind the scenes, tell me, is it a sort of organised chaos or is it a more focused process where everybody knows exactly what's happening?
Great question. It's probably somewhere in between, Richard. It's definitely not chaos. It's definitely very organised. But you can expect that there will be a good degree of jockeying for position.
Does that get tense?
The interesting thing is sometimes the tensions can be as much between, let's say, the Minister for Social Welfare and the Minister for Finance of the same party as they can be across parties. And that tension we see played out all the time between
Any
the
rows?
Tax side.
Tension.
Of course there'll be. There will be, but they don't necessarily devolve into rows. It's more that, you know, process of getting through, having discussions, one-to-one, you know, bilateral discussions. And then there's a time when, in particular in coalition, the party leaders and particularly the Minister for Finance and Public Expenditure will get around the table and get a decision, often quite late in the day.
Well, a very long and successful career in the civil service. I want to go back to the start. You grew up in Wexford.
I grew up in Wexford town.
And
that's important. The town bit's important.
Yeah. So you were a townie?
I was a townie. I wasn't a Culchie until I came to Dublin.
So the Culchies were the ones around you, but then when you came to Dublin,
yeah,
it was you.
I went to Loretta in Wexford, which actually was a boarding school. So quite seriously, we thought of the girls that came in and stayed in during the week who were from the farms and the small villages and towns. They were the Culchies. We thought we were very sophisticated townies until I came to Dublin and had to redesign my notions about myself.
And when you were in school, did you have an idea about what you wanted to do?
No, I mean, if you go back and I did my Leaving Cert at the age of 16 in 1972. So we're going back a long way at this stage. There was no transition year. I was in an all-girls school. Girls couldn't do honours maths. It wasn't considered to be necessary for girls. The marriage bar was in place in the civil service and in certain other employments as well. I was the eldest. I had three younger brothers. There wasn't a prospect that I would be able to go to university. My parents wouldn't have been able to afford that. Both of those would have left school in their teens themselves, very bright people.
It's a long list of what was closed off.
Oh, it was closed off. So, I mean, my options became, I considered teaching, but to go do teaching in Carysfort, you had to be able to sing or sew and both, and I could do neither. So that was out. So it came down to joining the civil service, and I was lucky enough to succeed in what was called the Junior X exam to be executive officer in the civil service in Dublin. And on the 18th of October, my parents, with my three younger brothers in the back seat, drove me to Dublin, where you had to report to the Civil Service Commission in Parnell Square, where they asked me what sort of work I'd like to do. And I said I'd like to work with people in a people-facing job. So they sent me off to the Revenue Commissioners the next day, to the Customs and Excise Division, as it turned out. And my parents drove me to Dublin Castle so that I'd know where to report.
How did you land accommodation? It's one of the great big challenges now. Very different
times.
I mean, it
is very different times, because the pattern at that stage for young people, particularly young women coming to Dublin from the country, was that you went into a hostel of some sort first. So I went to a hostel in Ranelagh, which would have been, you know, where young women who were working either in civil service or some of them studying would stay typically for the first year or two, and you went home for the weekend. And after that, typically you moved either into what we call digs, which was to stay with somebody, or then into a bedsit, which I did for a while on my own.
Were you excited about it all?
Oh, about the prospect of being in Dublin, very excited to sample that life, to get a bit of independence. There was a very early sense that things were beginning to change. The implications of joining the EC were beginning to dawn. Like when I joined, the marriage bar was in place. That went in 1974. Equal pay came in, I think, around 73, 74. So like the changes, the beginning to think of women as less than second class citizens was directly related to our membership of the EC, but also the beginning to think of ourselves as opening ourselves to the rest of Europe and the rest of the world was quite heady at that stage.
Do you remember your first day going into the revenue, and what was your first task?
My first task was to go into Customs and Excise Division 4, as it was called, over in Hume House. And I was handed the book called The Customs and Excise Tariff, which is a doorstopper, like a huge doorstopper. And I was told that I was going to be responsible for a number of chapters of that book. So what would happen would be something would come into me, like, let's say, a sample of the kind of plastic bracelet that you might get in a Christmas cracker. And I would have to decide whether it was a toy or a piece of jewellery. And one of my early bits of rebellion in the civil service was when I actually had the temerity to make the decision without looking to see if there was a precedent that this was clearly a toy. And this caused great grief because jewellery attracted a higher rate of duty. And my boss at the time reported me to her boss to say, you know, this young woman is stepping outside her authority. And his response was, well, at least she's showing initiative. And he actually supported the decision
so
I had taken.
Somebody was looking, had your back.
Yeah, somebody. So, you know, I it strikes me looking back now that there are two ways you could approach the kind of job I found myself in. And some did, you know, some people came in, joined the civil service, went into a department and stayed in that one department literally until the age of 65 and simply studied what was called the seniority list, because you only got promoted if somebody left, somebody died or somebody retired. Whereas from an early stage, I just felt there must be a way of doing this better or doing this differently. You could suddenly begin to unintentionally open up opportunities for yourself.
Was the social life good? Did you meet friends quickly
social
and enjoy life?
Social life was great at that stage, absolutely great, because I think the vast majority of us were all between the ages of probably about 17 and 20. There was a kind of a very defining moment for us a couple of years later in 1974 when the Dublin bombings happened. And unfortunately, I lost one of my closest friends in those bombs that day, and probably very, very nearly got caught up in it myself. And I think that was a huge change.
And what had happened?
On that particular day, which was in May 1974, it was a Friday evening. In fact, looking back on the statistics, a lot of young women got caught up in the explosions. There was a routine for those of us who were young civil servants working in Dublin that we would catch the train back to our hometown at the weekend and go to a dance on the Saturday night, in my case, in White's Hotel. And Siobhan Royce, who was a very close friend of mine, worked in revenue in O'Connell Street. I was still in Hume House. I rang her and said, look, we meet at our usual place, which was the junction of O'Connell Street and Talbot Street. And my boss overheard me and he said, you know, there's a bus strike. It'll take you ages to walk in. I'll drive you straight to the station. So I rang her back and said, no, look, a change of plan. I'll meet you at the station. He gave me a lift. The bombs went off as we were travelling into town. They went off around about 5:30.
Did you hear them? Were
we
you
did.
Close to the city
we
centre?
We did. We were close to the city centre. We were somewhere around the Mount Street area. I have an absolute blank about the moment the bombs went, from the moment the bombs went off to when I found myself wandering and really upset in Connolly Station looking for Siobhan. There was absolute chaos. The guards had stopped some of the trains because there was fears that the bombers would escape by train. The train to Wexford, which usually went shortly after 6, was delayed. I searched and searched. I got on the train. The train eventually got in, I think, about 10 o'clock that night into Wexford. I had no way of contacting my family. And to this day, I can see my parents, my three brothers on the station, sagging with relief. My mum and dad sagging with relief when they saw me come off the train. And Siobhan's parents, who were looking for her. And I had to say, I couldn't find her. I couldn't find her. And they identified her a few days later. But it was horrendous. And it, I think, was the day we lost our innocence. And it was the day the realities of what was happening in the north came home to us, because it was something up there. We knew about it, but frankly, we weren't as tuned into it. We were living a nice, happy life in Dublin, and this suddenly shocked to the core.
And do you find yourself reflecting on the events of that day and a close near miss for you and a tragedy for your friend?
I mean, I have many friends now and indeed my own husband who are all within that vicinity, because it was Friday evening in Dublin. It's where everybody was on the move at the end of a working day and heading home for the weekend. I think where it came back to me many years later, at the time of the peace process, I became head of the office of the Thánaiste when Dick Spring was Thánaiste, and I was in government buildings with a bit of a ringside seat to what was going on in those talks. I was not directly involved. It wasn't part of my role. But I got to see and meet a lot of the people who came to government buildings, like the first time Gerry Adams came to public to government buildings, the first time Davy Irvine came, Bill Clinton, all those things that went on in the peace process. I was involved in developing supports for women's groups at that stage and for local development. And with Dick Spring's permission, I spent some time up in Belfast working with women's groups on both sides of the political divide, the Shankill and the Falls. And it was kind of like as if life came full circle for me, that suddenly the conditions that had led to those horrendous bombings, there was now an attempt to really fix them. And seeing what it was like for people who'd lived with that all the time for many years, for me, was kind of really important to be part, in however small a way, of the process of making that better.
As your career developed and you found yourself moving up through the ranks of the civil mm-hmm. service, and I'm sure at times you also would have moved sideways mm-hmm. into something mm-hmm. else mm-hmm. Where you might even learn more. But you were Secretary General of a government department, only the third woman to have achieved that role. You must have seen so many of huge political figures in Ireland at yeah. work.
Yeah, and worked closely with them, and you see the whites of their eyes. The early years of my career were in the Revenue Commissioners, so not very political. And then I spent a number of years in what was the Department of Public Service and Civil Service Training and Development. And back in, I think it was around about 1987, the Department of Public Service was abolished overnight. And the job search programme was being created. It was a time of very high unemployment. And I was told that I was being sent from the Department of Public Service sideways to the Department of Social Welfare. I thought to be involved in developing and running the job search programme. I arrived in the door and was informed that I was being made press and information officer for the department, which was interesting because at that stage I didn't know the work of the department well, but you have to be a quick learner as a civil servant. But it also means then that you're working very closely with the government ministers. But overall, I would have said about my years in the Department of Social Welfare that there was a huge evolution from being something which was just about income support to thinking in a more rounded way about providing better service to people.
And what about changes of government? Sometimes a new government comes in and they will actually abolish a department or rename a department or merge departments. And if you're the civil servant, you're supposed to make all of this happen.
Indeed. And I described it as being like life on the fault line. So Social Welfare was a very stable department. The name just might change, but not a lot else would change. But I had been already abolished once in the Department of Public Service. Then when Dick Spring came in as Taoiseach, he wanted an office of the Taoiseach. And he actually first proposed the idea of a rotation Taoiseach, which people thought could never possibly work. But he insisted on the office of the Taoiseach being advertised as a competition within the civil service. And I succeeded in getting that. So that was fabulous to have those number of years at the heart of government. But then the government changed again. Bertie Ahern came in as Taoiseach. There was a bit of a spat going on, as I recall, between Mary Harney and Mary O'Rourke about which of them might end up as Taoiseach, depending on whether it was a coalition government or not. And famously, Mary O'Rourke said, well, I won't be needing an office of a Taoiseach if I'm the Taoiseach. So the new government came in. I found myself abolished again and sent to the Department of newly formed Department of Tourism, Sport and Recreation.
And do you find then that as the civil servant, you're kind of party to some of these conversations, but you're not really in the conversation?
No,
because that's a political thing.
It's very much a political thing. You get an opportunity always to talk to the outgoing government, whoever they are, about what might make sense or not. But ultimately, it's a political call as to what goes into the programme for government. But like the one which was possibly, as it turned out, the most influential in my own career was when the next government changed. I had just been made Secretary General of the Department of Marine and Natural Resources. The government changed. They decided to create a new Department of Transport. And literally that day, I got a call late that evening to say, oh, by the way, you're Secretary General of the Department of Transport now and Seamus Brennan is your minister. So as a civil servant, you're there preparing for various eventualities, but you don't know until the new Taoiseach stands up in the Dáil what the configuration of departments are going to be and who your minister is going to be.
You must have seen politicians going into the Taoiseach's office where there's a new government and they're going in to find out whether they're going to be promoted or keep their cabinet position.
In some ways entertaining, I'm sure not for all the players involved, is when I worked actually with Brendan Daly as Minister for Social Welfare, the office of the Minister for Social Welfare on the Leinster House side of government buildings is at the bottom of that, or was at the bottom of that long corridor, which is the walk from the Taoiseach's office right down the corridor through the doorway into Leinster House. And that particular day was quite extraordinary. This was after Charlie Haughey had stepped down. So you were watching their faces going in and you were watching their faces going out. So, I mean, I've often felt that my career was one of the privilege of having a ringside seat.
Bit of a spectator sport that day.
Definitely a spectator sport.
And after the civil service, you've done a whole range of things. You've sat on several boards. You were on the board of Ryanair. You're chair of PTSB Bank. How did the Ryanair one come about?
I had been about 3 years out of the civil service. And I should say that when I stepped down in 2009, having been an accidental civil servant and suddenly 37 years had gone by, frankly, I found it quite scary at first to be out in the big bad world. And suddenly I was just Julie O'Neill. I was no longer Julie O'Neill, Secretary General. So about 3 years later, I had some consultancy experience. I was chairing the audit committee in Trinity, a few bits and pieces on the board of the Museum of Modern Art. My phone rang one morning and it was actually Michael O'Leary. Which was very unusual because Michael and I would have had certain spats, let's say, when I was Secretary General of the Department of Transport. And to use the phrase, you could have knocked me over with a feather. It was probably the most unexpected phone call I ever got in my entire career.
Not least because Michael O'Leary would have been so critical of the officials and departments and the Muppets in the Department of Transport. It must have been a massive change. Were you in a bit of shock sitting around the
No, not in shock at all. But there's a few things I absolutely relished. One is the specificity and clarity of purpose that goes with being in a PLC like Ryanair. You've one job to do. It's fly planes, get people from A to B, whereas I had been used to a world which was extraordinarily complex and you always had about 20 different issues to juggle. The second thing that struck me about Ryanair and about working with Michael O'Leary, very, very good at being reactive to specific issues and dealing with them very fast, but never losing sight of the big picture, never losing sight of the long view. And I think where that would have come home to me most was when we hit the COVID crisis. So all of a sudden, if you think this was the biggest existential crisis ever to hit aviation, civil aviation, whole fleet has to be grounded overnight, all that goes with that. But from day one, Michael and the board were thinking about, this will end, how ready are we going to be to get planes back into the air? And I think that farsightedness and deal with the crisis immediately. Don't lose sight and be decisive. I found that both refreshing and really good, frankly, for my own development, and has helped me as I've moved in other PLCs.
And another PLC, PTSB, around the boardroom in the bank there. Is that very different experience to the Ryanair experience?
It's different in certain ways. Of its nature, banking can't be quite as fast-paced as aviation. But like aviation is highly regulated in the safety sense, banking, for all the very good reasons, is highly regulated. But for me, the reason I was attracted into banking and the reason I was very happy to come back as chair of the board of PTSB is because I feel banking is fundamental to the effective functioning of the economy, and it got extraordinarily damaged by the financial crash, but there are great people in it. We have a bank with a 200-year legacy. How do you build trust, and how do you develop a point of difference from the Revoluts and the digital newcomers and from the other big banks and other big players in Ireland, and provide something that's a unique service to Irish customers?
And throughout the decades that you were in the civil service and taking on bigger roles and bigger responsibility as well, what did your husband make of all of that? Was he sort of like, where are you going now?
Probably a bit sometimes. No, look, I think, I mean, when I look back, we married, I met Derry actually the first night that we did a business degree, PCOM, which we were both studying for at night out in UCD. We married very young. When I got the job in the Civil Service Training Centre, on the same day as I did the interview, I discovered I was pregnant with my daughter. I was only 23 years of age, and Shane was born, Claire was born. We'd taken on a mortgage and there was no proper childcare support or any of those things. So I was very dependent on he and I having a relationship where we mutually supported one another in terms of the childcare. But I would say, more importantly than anything, it's one thing to have the practical support. You need to have somebody in your life who's sufficiently comfortable in their own skin that they're not threatened by successful women. And that's not as usual, you know, as you might think, particularly in that era.
And he has been battling ill health.
He has. Unfortunately, he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer last year. He actually got good news yesterday that the treatment at the moment, it recurred, unfortunately, but he's stable at the moment. It's a huge change. Anybody, I actually had my own cancer battle a number of years ago, but a more minor one, which I recovered from fully. It's a very dramatic change, but I think it's the way you take these challenges on when you get them and face into it. And it really does encourage you to live in the moment. And we kind of take life in 3 month bites at the moment, because yesterday he had a good meeting. He's told next 3 months are looking good. We'll worry about next year.
Well, that's really great to hear. And finally, Julie, if you were to go back from what you've learned now and what you've seen around the private sector, mm-hmm. and Ryanair and the bank and so forth, if you went back into the civil service, would you do something differently?
That's actually a really good question. And in one sense, not a lot, because the worlds are different. But we still have to figure out how to join up the thinking better. And we need to get better at moving fast. What I love is the speed with which you can do things in the private sector. And sometimes we can slow ourselves up by the structures and systems we put around us. But I have to say, if anything, my respect for senior civil servants and politicians has grown since I left, rather than the other way.
Well, Julie O'Neill, former senior civil servant and chair of PTSB, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.